Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest is Fuzzy Morse, and he's, I was working on the show this week, and I was just blown away by so many people he's worked with. It's just a mind-boggling. He had some of my favorite artists too. I mean, he toured with Carla Bonoff and Kenny Edwards, but he's played with the Chambers Brothers, Rick Ocasek, Jaco Pastorius, Frank Zappa, Aaron Neville. I mean, Joan Baez. I mean, it's a pretty diverse group of people that he's played with, and you'll hear tonight some of the clips that we play tonight. You'll see just how diverse he is. Also, too, he's more than just a guitar player. He's a multi-instrumentalist, and he does a lot of on some of these clips, I'll talk about what he's doing, because he's playing keyboards, guitars. He's a flautist. Mm-hmm. And also, he's a producer, too. And we have a couple of clips of some of the stuff that he's worked on and he's working on some new projects. He's also composed for TV, film, and commercials, and he can talk about that too. That's especially commercials. That's an interesting gig. Yep. So anyway, welcome to the show. It's really, before I play a clip, I just want to give us a little bit of your background, where you came from and your roots and what you listened to and how you got to where you are today.
Thanks for having me. There we go. I'm an East Coast boy from Stamford, Connecticut, but I grew up mostly around New York. I had all sorts of young musical adventures there. And then at age 14, I moved to Rome, Italy.
Wow.
Yeah, I went to high school in Rome and then had a whole bunch of adventures in Italy and France and England and all across Europe, playing with my own band and sitting in with other people. And I guess I was always pretty fearless about approaching people. And so from a very early age, if someone was my hero and I had a chance, I'd go up and talk to them. And thankfully, people were very friendly to me, you know, and very open to me. And I ended up sitting in with people or playing with them and developing friendships and stuff. So one adventure after another from a very early age.
What was the music scene like in Italy? It must have been very interesting.
It was interesting. It was a time where bands like Pink Floyd and King Crimson were very popular, and the Italians always kind of loved prog rock. But you'd have the Italian version of it.
And like PFM.
Yeah. In general, though, nothing ruins an instrumental. That you're rolling with it wherever they're going, and all of a sudden this very heavy Italian accent comes in, and it's just sort of incongruous. Because you're used to hearing these lazy English voices like David Gilmour, and all of a sudden you hear "Squanto parente mio," and it's just all of a sudden you're in a completely other universe. I was in a band with my high school friends, and we were very popular, but we were like the American band, which was a rarity there. So we used to go up to Florence and play there and play in different towns, and we were long-haired young Americans, which, you know.
So you were pretty hip to what was going on in the States and England and stuff.
Yeah.
You were able to keep in touch with what was happening.
Yeah, I didn't want to leave America. I was in a band. I had a girlfriend, and going into New York City every weekend to the Fillmore East, and like, what are we going to Italy for? But my father was going to work there, and after about a week, I was sold on Italy. But first, I was pouting and didn't want to go there. But I was in a band within 2 weeks of being there.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and play my opening clip, which I think is this brilliant version of Voodoo Child. And this is from Dreams and Other Living Things,
yes.
your most recent album. And tell us a little bit who's playing on this, because you've got some great players on this cut.
Yeah, the band on the whole album are wonderful players and great friends. It's Jerry Murata on drums and percussion, Tony Levin on bass, David Sanctius on keyboards, and me on guitar. Even though I play lots of other instruments this time, I decided I'm just going to be the guitar player singer.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, yes.
But I do want to point out one thing. Take a listen to what Tony's doing, because he's using those funk finger bass. They're like... they're like little tube things, but like they're basically extensions of his nail, and he taps the string with these funk fingers.
Yes, with the end of the drumsticks.
Yeah,
kind of taped on his fingers.
And it's amazing sound. It's really it can be very percussive and funky, but it's interesting in this clip that he was doing that. But let's take a listen. This is Voodoo Child, and this goes where you go nuts on the guitar here. Take it, listen. That's great. And we were talking a little bit before the show, he was doing the panning, like if you listen to the original Hendrix cut, they fly it around like that.
Yeah.
Which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
So, but real quick, what were you using?
That was this guitar I have here, the Gibson Strat, playing into a Vox AC30, actually.
Wow.
Recorded it at Jerry Murata's studio in Woodstock, Jerry'sville.
Hi, Jerry. I hope you're listening.
Hey, Jerry. but yeah, that was sort of the amp I used for most of the sessions. I did some stuff overdubbed on a matchless at home. I have a matchless amp I really love. But the stuff there, that was Voodoo Child. We just did two live takes. And I used mostly take one and little bits of part two, but that was just a Fender Strat going into a Vox AC30.
What wah pedal were you using?
Is
it the one on that board?
I think so, yeah. Actually, good question.
Oh, that looks like that's a crybaby.
Yeah.
Stock?
Cry, yeah, completely stock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great. That's the sound.
Yeah.
No, it was a. It was an interesting arrangement too. And what Tony's doing behind you is it's an interesting little groove that he's doing.
Right. Well, I actually asked him to try the funk finger because I loved it, hearing how he'd used it with Peter Gabriel. Just love that sound. And he kind of eyebrows went up. Funk fingers? Yes. Yeah. And he did it for the whole song. And he's playing kind of almost a Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
Very rhythmic, like you said. And then with these occasional Tony Levin, he does this great little thing. But I did it in a drop D tuning. Usually people play Voodoo Child in E. Hendrix, he did it in E flat because he had a thing tuned down. That's too high for me, E. But I had the low string down to D, which gave me sort of a tiny little bit of somehow a Neil Young vibe to me. It was sort of like...
So you're using it's a D tuning.
Yeah, yeah. Regular tuning with the low string down.
Just the low down.
So I could hit that nasty low D. Yeah,
No, that's a great... it's a killer sound. I love that Vox. Now, you're cranking the Vox, right? That distortion is the amp.
Yes. I believe that distortion was pretty much almost all amp. I might have used... I have this thing here, the Bad Monkey, which is this very cheap, simple little pedal. It's like a $40 pedal. And it's not fancy, but all it does is add just a slight layer of tubiness to whatever. It doesn't change your original sound. It doesn't interfere with your dynamics and stuff. So that might have been on, but it's mostly...
So it's an overdrive. It's not a fuzz.
So it's an overdrive, very, very basic overdrive.
Well... since you mentioned it, before I forget, let's talk a little bit about this Gibson Strat, the story behind this. This is a very interesting guitar.
Yes. Well, it was originally a 1970-something Strat given to me by a girl who used to take it to the beach, this was in Miami Beach, and one of the worst places for an electric guitar, or any guitar, is the beach. I tried to encourage her, don't take that guitar to the beach. And at one point she said, well, you should have it. I can't really play it. And so it's been, you know, modified and bastardized and mongrelized in many, many ways. It's EMG pickups of the sort of David Gilmour kind of humbucking on a Strat. The neck is not the original neck. I think it's a Mighty Mite. The tuning pegs are these locking, what do you call them, spurtzels. And I had this very mischievous guitar tech who did many of these things to it, and he gave the guitar back to me once with the Gibson sticker on it instead of Fender, just as sort of a joke. But it kind of caught on, and it was kind of cool to have the only, you know, Gibson Strat. Strangely enough, neither Gibson nor Fender endorsed me. Hi, guys. this guitar got very visible. I was on a tour in 1986 with Lou Reed. I was playing guitar with Lou Reed. But on that tour, I befriended Joni Mitchell, who was a big hero of mine. And she needed a guitar as an emergency to play. She didn't have a guitar of her own. So she borrowed this guitar, and it was on this worldwide broadcast, Joni Mitchell playing the Gibson Strat. And so I heard all these great stories later, including one about Miles Davis, who she knew, and I don't know, but Miles Davis saying, I love them chords you're playing. He said, what the hell is a Gibson Strat? So I got a huge kick at even hearing him say the words Gibson Strat.
I'm surprised Gibson and Fender didn't call you like, hey, where did you make, you know, you can't use our name or you can't use our guitar, you know.
No.
They left you alone.
They've neither blocked me nor endorsed me, but it's life's still going, guys. Let's
see what happens after this show.
Yeah. Now, the bridge, are those brass?
Yeah. And again, virtually none of this is original except this. And there you can see it on the radio, right there.
Mm-hmm. That looks like that's an alder body, isn't it?
You got me. Whatever a 70s Strat was made of.
That again, like, the neck looks like rosewood with maple, but because part of that sound, that the 60s sound was that alder body.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those EMGs, and those are active, right?
Yes.
So
I occasionally, I used to have to open it up and wonder, is the battery still good? But now I have this lovely little thing I can I can plug in and it tells me how much battery life is left.
And then is that
a 9-volt battery in here?
Under the pickguard.
Yeah.
And then is that a 5 selector switch? Or
yes.
Did you change that?
I changed that too. 5 selector switch. Back then I still only made 3. Now I guess 5 is standard.
Do me a favor and just go through the different pickups and stuff so they get an idea what that thing sounds like.
Uh-huh.
And we'll play more clips of the guitar in a minute. But
okay, here's the bass pickup. One over. Middle one. Second to treble. And treble.
Now, playing now, in the session, you use an AC-30. What do you use live with that guitar?
It depends. If I'm playing around town, I have an amp that was given to me after I played at the NAMM show with Tony Levin and Jerry and those guys. That was my best swag day ever. I got 2 acoustic guitars. I got an amp. It was a really great day. I think we should do this more often. A fellow named Ted Kornblum, who now runs Magnetone, which makes very cool amps, was Ampeg at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, pick out an amp as a thank you. So I got a Crate, which sounds terrible, and it's an awful name, but it's a Crate 30-watt tube amp.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my go-to, put in the trunk of the car, always sounds good, always works. The amp that I love most, which I'll never take out now because it's too heavy for me to lift and they're really rare, is an early matchless. A matchless mm-hmm. with a separate head and a bottom. It's modeled on the AC-30. I mean, I think it's even called a DC-30, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing sounds gorgeous. Last time I used it was with the Chambers Brothers. I did a gig with them a few years ago down at this place downtown. And that thing just sings like crazy. Yeah. That's the amp you want to get beautiful musical feedback and everything.
Yeah, those are on the Flow guitar we had matchless and they're loud and clean.
Yeah.
But when you crank them, it's loud, but God, it's a great sound.
They're like completely musical at every setting. So that's actually, I love that. I mean, I don't own any, but I like a nice 50-watt Marshall too.
And yes, of course. Everybody should like a 50-watt Marshall.
Yeah. Yes. My least favorite amp's a Fender Twin.
Really?
Yeah. I stay away from them like the plague. They're just too piercing to me. I have to dial everything all the way back on them.
Yeah, what about Mesa Boogie? Have you played Mesa Boogie?
Yeah, I'm okay. I had a Boogie many, many years ago. I liked mm-hmm. it. It was a little squishy sounding, a little squished. I mean, now they're probably much better.
Well, you can almost every amp emulates every other amp, but it's almost it's unreal.
I like the little vintage Fender amps. I like the little ones, like you know, Princeton's and
oh yeah,
those Libro Kings and all those things.
So you crank those up in the studio.
Those sound great in the studio. Yeah.
Well, let's play. I want to play this vintage clip. You said there was a story behind it. This is with Rick Ocasek from the Cars,
mm-hmm.
from the Beatitude album from 1982. And you were telling me that you mentioned in the notes that you were playing his 50s Les Paul Jr. on there. Now, you're playing lead and feedback guitars, and I think I have the lead clip.
Yeah.
Rick's on rhythm, Daryl Jennifer on bass.
Yeah,
and
from the Bad Brains.
And Stephen George on drums.
Yeah.
So let me play that and tell us a little bit of this, the story behind this, because it's an interesting clip.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh,
Now that fade out's from the is the actual fade out of the clip, but it's funny because as it's going out, you're doing some really cool stuff, and I'm trying to let's just keep going. You got to hear all that stuff. Now you were using the 50s Les Paul Junior.
Yeah.
What else were you using on that?
No pedals. That was just and I think the amp I was using was Rick had a big Ampeg. One of those really big, the Stones used to use them, those humongous.
Oh, the, yeah, the...
It's not the SVT, that's the one...
The V something.
It's some, yeah. Yeah. This is 1982, so whatever that big Monstro Ampeg was. And there were no pedals on that at all. That was just the Rick's 58 or 59 Les Paul Jr. And it was great, when I went up to the studio, I thought, well, what do I need to bring? Because I was living in Florida then. Oh, no, you know, I got all kinds of guitars, whatever. I brought a guitar. But I saw that one there, and I went, oh, that looks intriguing, because it had just a volume control and a tone control. It was like, that's it. Simplest guitar ever, and the tone was just out of this world. So, yeah, and Rick and I go back a long way. I was the guitarist of a band before the Cars with Rick and Greg Hawks and Ben Orr, yeah. Band called Richard and the Rabbits. And we went our various ways. He was in the Cars. The Cars were already a big hit, and then Rick was doing his first solo album. He said, I want you to play guitar on it. But the funny thing about this one is that we had already recorded the lead, and they were really happy with it. And then Rick said, well, you know, because I was getting these really gnarly kind of sounds, can you do a track of just feedback, just the wildest-ass feedback, just whatever. So... we cranked the big Monstro amp even more. They're in the control room, and I'm getting all these sounds, which Rick said they were like dogs crying. He was very excited about it. I'm about halfway, two-thirds of the way through the take, and I'm getting all this great stuff, and it must have been the air pressure from the sound in the room got so great that my headphones just blew off. Just boom, like they got hit, like a hurricane. Now, all of a sudden, I'm completely exposed to this ridiculous level of volume. And I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to kill myself. I lay in the control room. And Rick and Ian Taylor, who is engineering, they're going, keep going. You got this. Is great. This is going. And I'm like going, ears, take. Ears. So I did it. I finished the take. And believe me, I lost many, many hearing cells permanently that day. Now I'm down to naming my remaining hearing cells. Like, but anyway. But yeah, the headphones blew off, and it was that moment, do I stop? And they're going, ah, keep going. So we got
wow.
the take.
I've heard people like blow out things with the bass, but never with a guitar. That yeah. must have been really
loud. It was loud. You couldn't even believe how loud it is. I remember they had, you don't see them anymore, these things called power soaks.
Yeah.
So you could crank the amp all the way, but it would, it's sort of like a master volume thing.
Attenuate. It just taps from the, so you get the, you can distort the tubes, but without pushing the.
Yeah, well, believe me, that power soak was turned off and the thing was on loud. And then when those things blew off, I couldn't believe, it was like the end of the world. But that's behind the solo there, is that sound.
No, it's a great sound. I mean, it was really, really, really interesting. Now, also, too, you do production.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to play a clip that, which is an interesting clip, of an artist that you're working with, Amanda Blue.
Yeah,
and you mentioned that you are in right now producing a new album for her.
Yes, I'm co-producing it with her. She's an absolutely fantastic singer from South Africa, and I did her last album with her as the guitarist. And we've already done and finished two tracks for this. We're starting some more. But I put together a band for her, great band, Chad Watson on bass. I know you know Chad. I don't know if you know Chad.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Chad.
Phil,
hope you're listening.
Yeah, hi, Chad. Gentle giant Chad Watson. Great drummer Phil Jones, mm-hmm. Best known from Tom Petty, I Won't Back Down, and, you know, all the playing with Peggy Young right now, but Neil Young and all those guys. And Steve Sykes, who also engineers and plays guitar. But we have a very nice band around her. So yeah, we're working on that now. She's very well worth hearing.
But this clip, if I'm correct, this is live. This is from her album Amanda Blue Live.
Yeah.
And this rhythm section was from Cape Town, South Africa. What was that like?
Okay. Well, this is a case where live had to have some very large quotes around it because they were live in South Africa and I was live in Los Angeles, but at a different time.
Oh, okay.
But the way we actually did it was that I went in, she had the tracks, and I didn't learn them or study them at all. I just reacted to them in real time.
Okay.
And that, so to keep it free, like I'm playing live with a band, they're just about.
So you're totally just gut reaction to it.
10,000 miles away or however far away they were.
Well, it's pretty tight for,
yeah.
Let's take a listen and you'll get an idea what he's doing. Now, were you just doing the lead guitar, or are you doing the rhythm? There's a rhythm guitar.
Yeah, I did both. I did both. There was a guy named Johnny who played some rhythm on the original. It's in there, but I did kind of the little Mick Taylor-ish background as well as the lead. Yeah.
Now, I presume that's the Gibson Strat.
That's the Gibson Strat.
Okay, and then what were you using amp-wise?
That was the crate that I mentioned, the 30-watt crate tube, yep.
That blue sound is just, it's nice. It's a really clean, it just has what I call bloom. There's a little bit of distortion when you dig in.
Mm-hmm.
It gets that, but it's still a really clean sound. And were you using the crate on the other guitar too?
Yes, same amp, same amp, different tone, same guitar. Wanted that to be, clean, but yes, like you said, with a bloom, it can sing a bit, not just go doink.
No, it's a great blues sound. I mean, it's right on the tone. And again, all of these clips and people check out Dreams and Other Living Things, because what he's getting on there, we'll play some more clips of that. It's the tone that he gets is just amazing on there. I want to play another clip of that you sent me, that you produced for. Richie Anhui, is that how you say it?
Ingui. Yeah, the cell survivors,
And which, sadly, he passed away.
Yeah.
But this is called Close Your Eyes, and can you kind of set this up?
Yeah, I've actually made music with Richie Ingui since I was 19 or something. He and his brother Charlie, they had a huge hit when they were teenagers called Expressway to Your Heart. Boom, boom, ba boom, boom, ba boom.
Who doesn't know that?
Yeah. And Richie just has one of the classic great soul voices of all time. They're Philly guys. And I worked with him on and off for years and then produced this song. I think it was about, I probably told you, early 90s maybe, 92. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, in the 1990s, and it's pretty much me playing everything on it. All of it.
Okay, take a listen. And again, this shows you the versatility in the many multi-instrumental, and the most, you as a multi-instrumentalist, it's hard to tongue twister. But he's playing everything on this. This is really good. This is Close Your Eyes.
Creeping in there at the end. Yeah.
But I mean, now the tone of that's just a great sound. Now is that the
Gibson Strat. I don't have the faintest idea what amp that was. That was so long ago. But judging from the sound of it, it's probably I've had every little generation of delay pedal, one way or the other. I used to have Echoplexes. Judging from the 90s, it might have been a little purple Dan Electro pedal, just a delay pedal. That's probably about
it. Oh, okay. So you didn't do it in post on the
no.
in the studio?
No, I think I usually print effects for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah, that's but that tone, it's just that bell-like. It's not. It's kind of glassy. It has a lot of top end to it,
yeah.
And it's that real clean type of. But the sustain, and then there's another. I think you did an overdub, where you're like volume pedal. You do a volume pedal thing, and you kind of come over and overlay it,
yeah.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, yeah, that's something. One of those, right there. Whatever it was.
Yeah, it's a very. I mean, it's a really tasteful. Tasteful thing, but now you're doing everything. Did you play drums on that too?
Drums, they're programmed drums. My friend Ronnie Margolis did the live cymbals and hi-hat. That was,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was programmed drums.
That's
and bass. That one, I'm not sure. There might be vibes on it too. I play vibes from time to time.
Let me see what you said in your notes. No, you just said you played everything.
Yeah,
all the other instruments. But it's a great sound. No, that's a really, really an excellent cut. Now I'm going to play another one from I don't know if you produced this with Andy Pratt or did you co-produce this?
I didn't produce it. My friend Fernando Perdomo produced it.
Hi, Fernando.
And he's playing rhythm
Fernando.
Guitar on this.
I'm just playing. Yeah, I'm playing the lead guitar in it. Andy Pratt played, I believe, bass and piano, and I think Fernando's playing rhythm, but Fernando produced
and
it.
And David Goldstein on drums.
David Goldstein, yeah, on drums.
And so this is called The Way I See It, and it definitely, he put a little note in there, Pink Floyd vibe. So
yeah.
You'll hear this, it's a great sound. Here's The Way I See It. That's the actual fade out of the song. And I'm listening to his thing, and there's like, and then he does this whole whammy bar thing, and then he's the very end. He's just doing these. So I always wanted to know what David Gilmour would sound like with a lot of Red Bull, and you, I don't know. You're just going nuts on there, but it's a great sound. I mean, you got that whole phrasing, and what now? That you were using the Strat.
Gibson Strat, and probably that's probably the Crate amp again, unless it was one of Fernando's amps. It was not anything special.
Now, which pickup were you using to get that tone? Because that's a pretty distinctive tone.
I change pickups all the time.
So I don't even think about it.
But yeah, I mean, even when a note is sustaining, just to give it a little extra something.
But I mean, like that, where you do that long bend.
Most likely the bass pickup or right in the middle.
The middle, yeah.
Yeah, for really long notes, I'm not usually using the treble pickup.
Right, I think you were using that when you were like...
Yeah. I do on that, yes. But,
guitar speak here.
Someone told me once, because I actually don't think about what I'm doing when I just do it. Someone said, you switched pickups about 15 times in that thing. And it's just sort of so subconscious. Mm-hmm. Just to squeeze a little bit more. And I have to say, David Gilmour is, and has been for many years, just one of my absolute favorite guitarists. I love his sound, love his approach.
Right, just getting just the pure absolute, taste.
Yeah, pure taste, beautiful melodies, just not a wasted anything, but it's great.
Absolutely. Now, did Andy Pratt, did he say, get me a Gilmour sound, or you just did that?
I just did that.
You just felt that?
I just did that. I've known Andy for a really long time. I played on his last two albums, but I know him going way back, so he was familiar enough with me that he kind of trusted me to do something, you know, that he would.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I love the way you do those, that one bend, you just pull it, and then, that's a classic Gilmour line, but it worked. And you're getting a great sustain out of that guitar.
Yeah. I work it. I don't use really light strings. I like to have resistance, and I like to...
What's your gauge on there?
10 to 46.
Oh, it's okay.
Very regular. But whenever strings are too light, I like to wrestle with them a little bit.
Okay.
Make them work, you know.
Now, besides the Strat, is it pretty much that's your main axe, or do you have Gibsons? Do you have any other guitars that you
use? I do. I have two other guitars I love. I end up using this for so much, not for one thing, because they're light, and I like mm-hmm. that. I have a 57 Gold Top Les Paul, mm-hmm. Which I love, but rarely, you know, take anywhere. And I have a 335 Gibson, which is from the 80s. It's not any particularly great vintage. So yeah, by this point, the 80s is a long time ago, so who knows, maybe that's, wow, an 80s, you know.
Yeah, actually, it's gone up in value, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm sure they have,
every
but
decade.
Yeah. The Les Paul is certainly that, and I love that, but again, it's how many places are you going to take that these days?
Now, the Gold Top, is that with humbuckers or the P90s?
Yeah.
The humbuckers, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but do you use them a lot in the sessions, or not as much?
I used to. I haven't lately. I usually grab this thing, because I know this so well that given various amps and knowing how to use various pedals, I can pretty much get what I want from this.
Right.
Unless I want a totally different sound altogether.
Right. Well, that's true, because you can even hear it. I'm going to play the guitar instrumental Onward that's from the new from your Dreams and Other Living Things. But your tone, it's hard to tell sometimes if it's, you know, Strat. I mean... The Hendrix stuff, obviously,
yeah,
because you're going for it. But I mean, it's true. You do get a full sound. I mean, you're not wanting it. It gets that Gibson type of sound.
I grew up as a Gibson guy, so I probably, subconsciously try to pull Gibson-y sounds out of this, even though it's a Fender.
Yeah. All right. Let me play Onward real quick, and then we can talk a little bit more about how that album was put together.
Okay.
And so let's play that now. And then also, too, this one is, again, Tony Levin, David Sanchez, Jerry Marotta, and you're playing guitars and keyboards on this. So here we go.
Thank you.
a beautiful cut.
Thank you.
Now, are you doing the strings, or is that real strings, or is that?
When we cut it live, Tony's playing bass, Jerry's playing drums, David was playing piano, and a kind of a string synth, both. And then I overdubbed other keyboard sounds after I got home.
Because it sounds very orchestral. I love the way that plays against the guitar. It's just great.
Yeah. Reverse engineered it after we had done the live track, and there were certain things like that David played that I wanted to underline or add to. So some of the orchestration is just what happened live, and some of it was me hearing go, oh, wow, okay, let's just add one more instrument playing that line and give it a little emphasis.
But I think that's a good example of what you said of switching around. You can hear the difference. I mean, you're pulling all these different tones. You're getting that real bright, like you're at the beginning, you're doing it's the treble pickup, and you're really just going at it, very aggressive. And then you go into, like, it sounded to me like either two pickups where you're getting like a more of a nasal type of sound out of phase, and then you go, and then you have that like bluesier sound.
Yeah, I would think it's either number two or number four for some of that stuff. I'm not sure.
But it'd be as beautiful because you're just, it's amazing. I mean, you do it like almost in the middle of a phrase. I mean, you're quick.
Yeah.
And that's great. I mean, it's very distinctive sound-wise.
Yeah, and again, it's something I do. There's other something else I do, and I do it when I'm playing bass, too, is that I'll play with my fingers, and I'll hold a pick, and I'm not quite sure how the pick stays on my hand, and I think if I thought about it, I'd drop it. So, like, if I'm playing bass, I'll do this kind of thing, and then somehow the pick goes into my, it's like a little juggling trick. But I've never slowed it down. If I did, I'd probably drop the pick and I'd look like an idiot.
You just tuck it probably in one of your
fingers. Yeah, it gets tucked in, but same with the pickup changing thing. Like,
see, there you go, where he's playing a note and he switches the pickup while the note's still going. And that's a whole different sound. I mean, that's very unique.
Yeah.
Now, talking about a little bit about arrangement stuff, I just want to touch briefly, because we're almost out of time. I wanted to mention the, because you've done film and TV and commercials.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you're doing commercials. What was that? What was that experience like?
Well, I had done. Actually, I used to work on commercials in Florida, jingles with a friend of mine. And it was fun. And I liked the format. I liked the fact that something's 28 seconds long or 50, whatever. I got into scoring movies when I moved out to L.A. Mostly movies nobody would want to see, including me, you know. But that's the kind of movies you get, you know. And, you know, you'd work really hard and you'd be scoring a scene, you'd be really happy with the music, you'd get a good mix of it, and the next thing you know, there's lightning going all over the scene, or rainstorm, or some sound effect drowning out. So you kind of, oh man, why did I go through all that work? I started doing commercials after that, and then really, again, started enjoying the concise, you know, pungent little format.
Let me ask you, from playing, like producing all these different people, where you're doing developed melodies,
right?
And you know, you're taking 16 bars, 32 bars to develop a theme, and now you have to do it in like 5 seconds and make a whole song.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Wasn't that a weird change?
I actually kind of liked it because things come in and out the door faster. Commercials tend to pay better.
You know, that's true.
Which is enough motivation. You know, you're doing 30 seconds of music for more money than you were doing, you know, an hour and 10 minutes of music for, so if you can get it. I hooked up with a wonderful company and a dear friend, a guy named Ron Diamond, Acme Filmworks, and they do what you would call fine art animation commercials. I mean, when you see this really cool ballerinas made out of swirling sand and, you know, this kind of thing, that's what they specialize. So I did a number of commercials for him, which I really enjoyed. Ron, it's about time for another one. But you were actually working with visuals that were very cool. And so that helps. I mean, if you're doing a really stupid commercial for a really awful product, then, you know, it's like, okay, just...
No, but I mean, it wasn't a problem for you to develop a theme in that short of a time.
No, not really, no. You just get different sorts of notes and feedback than you would get in any other composing thing. These very odd things like, we love it, it's great. But between 14 seconds and 14 and three-quarter seconds, could you go boom? You know, to get these little, we need a boom there. And so, okay, I think if I can come up with a boom, and then you can make a boom. I like the boom. Can you make the boom louder? From 17.3, you know, it's a different sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't mind. It's okay.
No, that's why, because people don't understand. That's, unless you've done it, it's a whole different game. It's a whole different way of writing and stuff where you're basically, it's so compacted and squeezed together. And it's amazing when you listen to some of the stuff that's out there. It's a full musical statement, and they actually, you can emotionally add to whatever the visual is in such a short time. To me, it's amazing.
Yeah. One of the things that's tricky is that if you have a really short, the ending... You can't have anything hanging over. You can't have a reverb tail or something like that. So when you end it, you got to really end it without it sounding so abrupt. But it is abrupt.
Right.
So
right.
Things go da da da, boom, gone. You're out. You know.
Yeah.
Anything else would have a little,
little
glory around the edges.
No fade outs.
No, yeah. No fade outs.
You don't get to do fade outs.
One more boom. Can you fit another boom in there? Maybe 22, 23 seconds. We need another boom.
That's funny. No, it's funny how they communicate. Yeah. You're interpreting what they want.
Yeah.
I need more boom.
Yeah,
I need more oomph.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing.
Right.
No. Well, I told you it would go by really fast, and we just scratched the surface, so we obviously have to have you come back. There's so much more to talk about, and there's even, you know, he gave me a bunch more clips. Check out Dreams and Other Living Things. This is a great album, and there's a lot of great, you know, Tony Levin, David Sanchez, Jerry Murata, just some amazing musicians. I mean, you've played with some of the best. Even just the story about Joni Mitchell using your Strat. I'm like, I'm not worthy. I'm not. But... it's just it's amazing what this album is. A great album. I really like it, and I think you guys should check it out because the tone that he's getting. And I really quick before we, I almost forgot to mention it, is the most important thing that you've done musically, and that's the Flying Finelli Brothers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. The Flying Finelli Brothers. Flying Finelli Brothers is a three-piece band. Myself, Nick Jameson, and Gary Anthony Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire act was based, you could say, on heckling. And the entire thing is like if heckling taken to the highest level. All three of us play lots of instruments, and all three of us are very good at making up lyrics on the spot. So in various ways, we would get audience suggestions, often would boil down to a subject and a type of music. And you've seen that, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway, with someone singing along with the piano doing a blues song. That's the easiest version of this. But we would, like, get a title. What's the name of an opera? And it was a hairdresser from Reseda. And I went into Roberto Benigni character at that point, because he was in it. And then Nick would play these strings, this string opera sound, and I made up a whole thing in semi-fake Italian and whatever, and get... We had setups, but every time someone would see us, they'd know what the setups were. The setups were just an excuse to make the whole thing up. But lyrics on the spot, really high level, really fun rhymes. We did Dylan stuff. We did reggae things. We did a Rat Pack thing where we did like Sinatra and Dean Martin.
Awesome.
And you name it. But the musicianship was at a very high level, and they were just very funny shows, and the audience knew that they were seeing something that had never happened before and would never happen again.
Now, it's Flying Finelli.
Finelli.
F-A-N-N-E-L-I?
Finelli. F-A-N-N-O-L-I.
Finelli. Finelli.
Finelli. Like cannoli.
Cannoli.
Yeah.
Finelli Brothers.
And the Flying Finelli.
They're on YouTube, right?
Yes, you can find it on YouTube.
So you have to check this out. This is really
not good. Like Lynn Finelli.
Yeah.
And His website is www.fuzzbee.com.
That's right.
With two Z's and two E's.
And anything coming up, first of all, I want to thank Lori for introducing me to
Fuzzy.
This is really great. And then
thank you.
You were mentioning there's a special concert coming up this year.
There's, that's sort of just a separate news flash here. It's for Hurricane Harvey and Irma. It's a fundraising campaign that will be sort of an all-star event up at Bogies in Westlake Village, and it's taking place next Monday, week from tonight, which is the 2nd of October. It's called, I think, United Rockers for the Hurricane Benefit or something. You can find it on Facebook pretty easily. And if you're up in the West Valley, come check it out. There'll be a whole bunch of us playing up there. Also, should I mention about the show?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. So now we're back here in the room. And two shows that Fuzzbee will be playing together with Freebo, who's been on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it Freebo and His Fabulous Friends. Mm-hmm. And Fuzzbee's obviously one of them, along with Chad Watson and John Mallow on drums.
Yeah, John Mallow.
And so they will be back at Viva Cantina in Burbank on the 21st of October, which is a Saturday night, so there's no excuse. You guys have to come out. It's a weekend. And then back at Bogies, which is going to be, let's see, I think it's the 30th of November,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right
after Thanksgiving, so or Thanksgiving weekend or whatever. So,
yeah,
it'll be a lot of fun. Freebo's always a lot of fun, and it's just a great band. Seen them a few times, and it's just
amazing.
Super great. Yeah,
but
folk
yeah,
rock and blues. And,
we
you know.
Definitely have to have you back. Do you have any idea? I know you're only two songs in, but when Amanda's album's going to be done, or you have a
Amanda's planning for a Valentine's Day release. So,
oh, okay.
Not till February, but we've got probably four done, but you know we're not working real fast on it. But
okay,
it'll be done.
But well, when it's done, maybe we can have you guys come back and talk about the whole construction of the album and how you put it together.
Your favorite subject, right?
I love
the producer songwriter relationship.
Hey, tonight, I loved about. Add the boom. I need the boom at 14. I know exactly what's up. I mean, that's
no.
Boom.
Wow.
Boom. There you go.
Awesome.
I'm gonna leave us with another clip from Dreams and Other Living Things, and this is another Hendrix song. This is Angel, and it's just it's with Tony, Jerry, and David Sanchez again, and it's just a great another one where it shows some amazing guitar playing. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you, Lori, too, for being who you are.
You're welcome.
And what you do.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jeff.
All right, here's Angel. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Oh.